Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to the AEW Dynamite Review. I'm Adam Wilborn from What Culture, joined by one of the Dadley Boys, Michael Sidgwick from What Culture, to review everything that happened on last night's episode of AEW Dynamite. But before we get into it, if you're a fan of this sort of thing, make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling on either iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts, where we not only review AEW Dynamite, but also AEW Rampage, Raw, SmackDown, NXT, pay-per-views. We have interviews, roundtable discussions, and a roundup of the week, complete with a bloody a quiz, of course, on wrestle culture. As I said, though, joined by Michael Sidgwick to review AEW Dynamite. Michael Hamflett still enjoying that well-earned week off. And what did you make of the all-out go-home show for Dynamite, Sidge?
Well, I'm hyped as hell for All Out, which should answer your question. I thought this functioned tremendously as a go-home show without being an absolutely perfect episode of episodic television in and of itself. There were certain flaws, there were certain developments that I was just perplexed at why I should care.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, we'll get to that goddamn rubbish later. We're still not at that February 2020 peak where literally everything, top to bottom, was virtually flawless and it was awesome. The reasons for that will become apparent as we review this show. There are certain creaking, boring white men polluting this television show, and I'm starting to get goddamn sick of it because I know how good it can be. However, as a go-home show, knowing that TV is a more lucrative revenue stream than anything else, so it balances payoffs in addition to hype and anticipation, this was beautiful mostly.
And I know I do this as a gimmick often, but and we'll talk about it in more detail. I just want to get your quick reaction to, quite possibly, the best 54-second build to a match ever!
Yes.
I mean, I've literally written it verbatim, yes. So we'll get to that in due course. Let's start with FTR versus Santana and Ortiz, as you sort of called. This opened the show. I'll run through the action and then we'll talk about what happened because I know you had concerns going into that and see if this match addressed that lovely touch. Of course, FTR wearing the Bobby Eaton inspired gear, really like that. Santana Ortiz coming out in their face paint to show they're really bloody taking it seriously. We start off with Dax Harwood and Santana. Very even, of course, these two teams. Breaks down basically to a free-for-all. Santana and Ortiz take him out to the floor with a clothesline and hit a wonderful double dive through there, which I know you enjoyed. They whip FTR into the barricade and Santana flips off Ortiz's back into both of them. In the end, though, FTR recover. They do one of those blind tags where he just reaches behind him, still hand-slapping, not back-slapping, none of that bollocks, basically. All serious stuff here. And they take control. They send Ortiz into the post, and I think that's when they go to a break. When we come back, FTR still in control. Cash has ripped off the turnbuckle pad, and they're trying to use that whilst the official is distracted. Santana stops them. Ortiz comes back. Santana basically makes a one-man comeback later on against both of FTR, hits the Three Amigos, gets a huge reaction from the crowd, goes for a frog splash, nails that, two count off the back of that. Santana and Ortiz then hit that double-team wheelbarrow cutter and a German suplex, but Cash comes in to break up the fall. Dax hits that spike brainbuster, which of course won them the match previously, for a great near fall. Santana and Ortiz go for the street sweeper. Dax breaks it up. Cash hits a gory special facebuster for a near fall. And then they're setting up for that one where one of them hits a superplex and the other one hits a dive on the ropes. But Santana and Ortiz foil that. They did manage to hit the big rig, though, to get a near fall broken up by Santana with a big dive. right at the last second. So then Santana hit a rolling cutter. Ortiz hit a lung blower. Santana hit a thrust kick. And then they hit that double team inside out suplex. 1, 2, 3. Santana and Ortiz finally defeat FTR. I mentioned at the beginning there you had concerns, particularly off the back of the last match. Did this match allay them for you?
Yes, this was excellent. I still think they have a better match in them. Bad news, good news first, because, you know, I'm a glass half full guy. Mm. I like to leave people with a nice feeling. So the bad news was FTR's heat sequence dragged somewhat, lulled somewhat at the midway point. There was one kind of awkward timing miscue that I was a little bit confused by. Deeper into the match before that electrifying finish.
Was that the superplex bit? Yeah, like he was almost like waiting to be caught on the top rope to break it all up.
Yeah, just a slight timing miscue
there. But I suppose you could argue, oh, he was still getting in position because his arm, he couldn't quite lift himself.
Another thing. They tried to play off the story of the original match as all great sequels should do. So I think that was a part of it. And I don't know if it didn't work because it wasn't articulated enough by the commentary team when they tried to do a callback to the spot with Cash's arm. The commentators should have sold that with abject terror, and they kind of lost it altogether. But beyond that, FTR in the opening 3 minutes of this match were absolutely sensational. The function of an amazing Southern style heel team is to be in position with Swiss watch timing to make the baby faces look like these athletic wonders. The first 3 minutes, they were exceptional in that role. Mm. They made Santana and Ortiz, and you know, I'm not saying they carried them, but I'm saying their role in this match, in the genre, they made them look absolutely awesome. That was great. The middle was a little bit baggy, but the timing on everything, like the timing on that big rig save, one of the closest near falls I can remember in quite some time. That was tremendous. The using the brainbuster as a near fall was tremendous. And it was almost, it's like there was nothing serendipitous about that first match at all. But if you're going to use anything from it, you've restored the power of a signature move effectively by using it as a near fall in the sequel. That was tremendous. The all action save spree in the finale really elevated this match after that baggy middle. And I still think they have an even better match in them. Maybe we'll see it. Maybe not. But at the very least, following that match, and I didn't have this feeling at all after the first, even before the injury, I would desperately love to see this get ran back. The gear looked incredible. Mm. They should simply wear that all of the time. Loved it. It wasn't just a beautiful tribute. They looked awesome. Yeah. They looked like a totally beautiful, modernized 80s tag team wearing them. Yep, this is great. I still think they have better in them.
Maybe they're holding back on that match, because I agree. I think there was still, you know, it was far better than the last one, which had its issues before the injury. Maybe they're waiting to run it back later down the line when maybe Santana and Ortiz are tag champs, because we've discussed in the past them possibly them being the ones to take the tag titles off the Young Bucks. Of course, the team that really should do that is 2.0, and they came next. They were stood there with their, quote, son, Daniel Garcia. They talked about, you know, the big CM Punk versus Darby Allin match. They said they're excited about it. Not to see the match, to take the match away, because they're going to beat the shit out of Darby Allin, basically. And Garcia cut a promo because he's going to be facing Darby Allin on Rampage this week, saying he was going to twist Darby Allin's body and hurt him in ways he couldn't imagine. My only issue is this, is just they probably just spliced in that footage of him torturing Matt Sydal, because I just love that submission that he does.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was followed by a promo by CM Punk. I apologize for this in advance, just said your tweet on the news about this. I did give you credit for it, but you nailed it, so we'll talk about it in a second. Because he comes out, he milks the, you know, milks. He appreciates the CM Punk chants, asks if we're sick of him yet. He says, it's all too good to be true. I could spend weeks, months just feeling all this love. There might be some people who are getting tired of it real fast, but he isn't one of them. He's doing his best to enjoy it while it lasts. He knows on Sunday against Darby Allin, this all could end. He's not wrestled in 7 years, he reminds us. He's nervous, maybe even scared. There's a you still got it chant going on in amongst all this. He said, knowing that it all could end, though, he's got a promise for us. He promises that every time he laces up his boots and comes down that aisle, he'll give us, bang, in comes Daniel Garcia in 2.0. 2.0, mark it down in the history books, the first people to lay out CM Punk. Brilliant. They beat him down. Punk did get some offense, and he saw him coming, the crowd reaction. He's not a complete dumbass baby face, basically. But the numbers game, obviously, catches up to him. They beat him down until Darby Allin and Sting make the save. They come out to even the odds. They beat all of them down. They all hit their finishers. Scorpion Death Drop, Coffin Drop, and a GTS on, I believe it was Jeff from 2.0. He hit it on. Huge bap from that. And then it was Sting's turn to get on the microphone as, oh, what a shot that was. Darby Allin and CM Punk go forehead to forehead. Sting says, look, he's always wanted to share a ring with CM Punk. Mucho respect. he didn't quite say it like that. It just tickled me that he says it. It's like when he says the first line after he beats Hogan. I can't remember where. He says, like, you think he's, I can't remember, but he says something absolutely ridiculous for someone who hasn't spoken in about 18 months. Anyway, he says, the path never did cross. All these years have gone by. That was then, this is now. Speaking of now, felt very good to watch her go to sleep, happen before his very own eyes and see a coffin drop, and just felt good to be all together and clear all that traffic together. Look, he says he doesn't want anything to get in the way, anything to stop this match on Sunday. He says that includes him. He says, this Sunday, Darby's ready. CM Punk is ready. He's going to fist bump Darby and all out. It'll be showtime for sure. And Excalibur just confirms on the commentary, that means Sting will not be ringside for this match, which I thought was a great touch. And you said on Twitter, which I'm just going to let you talk about now, how this was timed to perfection.
It was absolutely timed to perfection. Of course it was, because this is the go-home show. We'd seen this wonderful, life-affirming, really warm series of appearances by CM Punk, the human being, Phil Brooks, putting on like a really sort of profound, not performance, that's almost my tiny little niggling problem with it. It wasn't a performance at all, and therefore didn't really feel like a pro wrestling storyline that you can't wait to see the conclusion of. They knew this. They knew it was time to flip the switch and turn Phil Brooks into CM Punk. And again, with The very second I thought, this one again, oh no, of course, they're cleverer than that, of course they are. You got CM Punk forehead to forehead with Darby Allin. You got CM Punk selling a beat down. You got CM Punk, as you mentioned, going, right, I'm not an idiot. I can see what's coming here, and I've got balls. I'm going to go down swinging. He did precisely that. His punches in the corner, they got such little evidence to analyze of, is Punk back? On the briefest glimpse we got, which was all we needed.
Yeah.
Because you want to see so much more of this. Oh, we have to pay $50 to see it. Well, of course, I saw that brief tantalizing glimpse. All of this was measured to total perfection. I love the nose-to-nose, forehead-to-forehead thing. It's like, they're going to have a fight. They respect each other, but they are going to have a fight, and CM Punk's going to wrestle. All of that was great. His punches looked great. The GTS was pitch perfect. One of my favorite things about the segment is that Sting, and this is magical, incidentally, has somehow been presented as, I'll remember how the kids in 1988 felt about the Stinger. We're going to make 35-year-olds feel that about 62-year-old Sting. And the magic is, Sting can go to a standard where he can pull off that role. Sting, who has somehow been presented as this ageless, mythical icon, put over this match by saying, oh, it's way bigger than me. Like, bigger than Sting. Mm. When Sting is being Sting on TNT, it feels, again, magically, like nothing's bigger than that. And he was like, well, this is way bigger than me. It's like, he's the icon. Lovely little touch. We know it wouldn't have made any sense whatsoever for Sting to be at ringside to do his sort of really endearing nostalgia shtick. Doesn't fit the context of the match. This was the decision they had to make. But framing the decision like this, showtime, but not for me, really put over how enormous this match was. I got the glimpse of really real CM Punk that I needed. Sense of competitive animosity that just about went over the line of this mutual respect. Electrifying tease of what CM Punk can do. Awesome, awesome, awesome.
You can tell I've been watching 2 days of WWE prior to this, because when he was cutting that promo, I was like, this is great. Mamacita, that's what he yelled after he didn't speak for ages. I've just remembered. But because of my WWE head, I was like, oh my God, he's going to name himself special guest referee. And I was like, don't do it. Don't do it. Please, no, don't do it. And then, of course, he just went, no. Like you say, put the match over, huge, quite right. And just like you say, the brief glimpses of the punches in the corner and the GTS, obviously. And yeah, the story of Darby Allin saving CM Punk to make sure maybe that's going to be repeated on Friday. We'll talk more about that, of course, in the AEW Rampage preview tomorrow.
And then they can do Punk and Garcia on Dynamite.
Oh, or Punk versus 2.0, and that's his first loss. Just right, we had a video package for Kenny Omega versus Christian Cage with all the people on the broadcasters saying what they thought about it all, and Paul White finished by saying, All Out might be the worst night of Omega's life. Lovely touches all amongst that. And then we got the sit-down interview with MJF, introduced by Tony Schiavone as the most disgusting and despicable individual he's ever met. Thanks for this, Tony.
It's so awesome how Tony Schiavone, and they've done this literally since day one.
Yeah.
Where Tony Schiavone, I think on the very first Dynamite, when he's a cocky prick, and the magic of how this puts over MJF is that everyone hates him in that company. Like, if you remember the Revolution match, sorry, I'm talking over you here. The magic of the Revolution match is like Cody was about to whip him with a belt, and the ref, I think it was Paul Turner, was like, no, no, no. And Cody gestured towards him to say, like, come on, it's him. He's like, go on then. You can have one because everyone hates him. And it rules, and it's so effective that Tony Schiavone hates him, because Tony Schiavone, to glorious, just so charming effect, plays the guy who loves everything about AEW. Oh, it's a flip. Like in 2040, you'll see someone do a tope suicida, and you'll still love it. He loves AEW.
Britt Baker's a heel, ostensibly, and he's there doing the DMD with her.
Yeah. He loves everything about his job, this company, this organization. He is the soul of it, and he hates MJF. Because, of course, he does, because MJF's an arsehole.
And he's going to have to be the one to introduce the new world champion MJF down the line, of course, and hold the mic for him. Oh, anyway, MJF cutting this promo ahead of his match with Jericho at All Out, runs through all of his nicknames over the years, of course, talks about Jericho being on top for 4 decades of professional wrestling. He said, look, you're going to be etched into the Mount Rushmore of professional wrestling. But then when all is said and done, I'll take your place. We'll probably change it after that. He says, look, Jericho, you've got... he talks about the shoes he's got to fill. He says, like Muhammad Ali, you're just coming back one too many times, basically. You're on a downward spiral. He talks about these issues that Jericho is having more and more often. But Jericho is this addict. He needs the spotlight. And that's why he's foolishly basically put his career on the line. And at All Out, MJF will end one of the greatest runs in professional wrestling. It is poetic, he says, that the same yearning that brought Chris Jericho to the dance will be the reason the music dies. This is why I love MJF's promos, because, in terms of what we always say, put your opponent over, but still say, it's going to be bad news for you on Sunday. Personified there.
His delivery was exceptional. The content of the promo was brilliant. It was almost chilling. It was that he struck that note of, can you really be saying things like that? Like
calling Muhammad Ali's brain scrambled and stuff. It was just, but he's a heel, so he can, yeah.
Indeed. Enough time has passed. It's not cheap. This was incredible. Dark tone, and it had to be. He's doing the big sell for the pay-per-view. His delivery was exceptional. The tone was brilliant. I was most impressed with, he's got such a wonderful rhythmic delivery where he can just, it's like a scattergun. He can rattle, 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 rattle off his spiel. And he did that a wonderful effect by chronologically running through all of Chris Jericho's nicknames. And in about, 4 or 5 seconds of TV time, with his wonderful delivery, this is before he even says anything, and what he said was brilliant and affecting and, very much on the edge, as we said. Before he even said anything, he's captured the sheer heft, longevity, versatility of Chris Jericho's legendary career.
Lionheart, the man of 1,004 holes, the champion, all that sort of thing.
Absolutely incredible stuff. He's done the thing that we bury people in WWE for doing, but it's MJF and he pulls it off magnificently. He's read his Wikipedia page.
Yes.
And he's put it over because his delivery is so awesome. He really felt like not a performer.
Mm.
There's an element to MJF stuff where he loves the spotlight and it's all in character. This felt like possibly his most real AEW promo yet. He wasn't trying to bait the crowd. There was no crowd there to bait, of course. He simply came across as this bone-chilling sociopath who's not in the business of riling up the crowd or mocking people. This was sinister stuff. And I was completely wrong in the preview yesterday. He absolutely had to do this sitting down because the amount of heat he generates and how great he is with his off-the-cuff wit, he has to sort of play to the crowd. And I don't think that interaction would have sold just what might be facing Chris Jericho better than this sit-down did.
And it was worked perfectly with the word of the day toilet paper dichotomy between this and JR and Chris Jericho in the ring.
Oh, Christ, I.
Which we'll talk a little bit about later on. What we got next was the match between Jack Evans and Orange Cassidy. Matt Hardy attacks Orange Cassidy before the match even starts. Immediately, of course, gets ejected, but that allows Jack Evans to take control and beat him down, beat him up in the corner. But finally, Orange Cassidy fights back, avoids an elbow in the corner, hits a flying DDT for a two count. Evans manages to avoid the Orange punch, but gets hit with one of those tope suiciders by Orange Cassidy, I think, as we go to break there. Eventually, we see... No, we can't have gone to break because I remember what happened in the break of this match because Orange Cassidy hit a diving crossbody, hit a Michinoku driver, and then did those kicks of his before just about a sequence of a ridiculous number of the standing switches between the two. Eventually, Orange Cassidy climbs the ropes. Evans cuts him off and they battle on top. And we wonder what's going to go on. And they cut to commercial. You and I watched this on our friends at Fight. So we saw what happened. But for anyone not paying attention in picture, it comes back and the pin's already happened. Would love to know your thoughts on that decision. Basically, what happened was Orange Cassidy small packaged Jack Evans to get the pinfall victory. Post-match, the HFO come down. Well, sorry, Hardy comes down to attack him. Then the best friends, or Chuck Taylor and Wheeler Yuta, come down to make the save. The rest of the HFO come down to give them the numbers advantage and just overwhelm them. But thankfully, Jurassic Express come down to run off HFO. That a separate match on the kickoff, on the buy-in. We'll talk about that more on our All Out preview podcast, which should be out over the weekend. And instead, let's talk about the decision, the match and the decision to have the finish go on picture in picture.
The match was fun enough. The standing switch spot amused me.
Hmm, yes.
It did. It was pretty much sub-Chikara slash house show fun. Nice bit of variety to the show because it's going to be very intense. You must buy this pay-per-view. We all hate each other at the perfect time sort of fair. So it was nice to get a balance, I suppose. I was quite amused. It wasn't anything special or hilarious. I did enjoy Jack Evans' total slapstick bumping. Really good.
Did he say freshly squeeze my ass at one point?
I don't know, but I wish he did.
I feel like he did. I don't know. I just remembered that.
So that was, it was fun. Nothing more. I'm in support of ending the match in picture to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's good that they've established that it could happen, right? But at the same time, they're not going to do it all of the time. The precedent that they've set isn't really going to mean anything. And I don't know if it necessarily should. I mean, I guess it's nice. It creates a sense of realism.
Mm-hmm.
It, in terms of your TV viewer retention strategy, it in theory makes people think, oh, a pivotal match might end during picture-in-picture. It won't, but they might dupe them. If you cast your mind back to October, I think, or November 2019, they established that the TV time remaining thing
mm-hmm.
isn't just this little concession to something that might realistically happen. John Moxley and Pac fought to a TV time remaining draw. There was simply no time left to continue the match. It was good to establish the precedent at the expense of a narrative hook that would convince people to watch the next episode. What does that mean now? They haven't done enough AEW in general. They had quite a bit of this in 2020, which was really appreciated. But, you know, you have to keep reminding the people of these things. They haven't done enough of establishing the time limit draw and the wonderful drama that comes with the frantic desperation of beating the clock. So I'll reserve judgment on how clever this was. And again, it's the sort of match that no one really cares about deep down, that no one's emotionally invested in Cassidy and Evans. So it's the best choice to do an idea that will only work if you revisit it. As it stands, they haven't done the TV time remaining draw for 2 years. 2 years is a long time in wrestling. It's even more of a long time. It therefore no longer matters. Let it play out, except this time it's not ironic because it's AEW, so you're allowed to actually invest in these things.
Yeah, for a split second, I'll admit, I was like, we're watching on Fight, so it's a different experience for us. So the finish happened, and then Excalibur does the welcome back to Dynamite, the match is already finished. So it was, that was kind of surreal.
I was taken aback because usually you can tell they do a big pan out shot and go, we're back here on Dynamite.
It's like 5 seconds of silence.
And then they didn't do it, I'm thinking, oh, that must have happened in the break. So it did take me aback.
But yeah, I initially went, oh, that's weird. And then I thought, I quite like it, actually, because I always used to think, they used to do this, didn't they, when they had, like, Formula One on ITV here in the UK. And it's not like they can go, right, lads, we're going to a break, so no one overtake anyone. Like, you'd come back sometimes, and they'd be like, Schumacher's winning somehow. And you're like, what? So I do like that. And the way it instills in the audience... The thought process of, it's not just don't look away, i.e. make sure you squint and watch the picture in picture, but it is don't go clicking around elsewhere because you come back and the finish could be happening right then, let alone happening during picture in picture. I thought it was a nice take on things, and like you say, we'll see where it goes from here genuinely as part of AEW going forward. And I wasn't there, you know, this wasn't a main event title match, let's say, that they've gone, well, the title's changed hands in the ads. Like, it's something and nothing, and we're getting the match again at All Out on the buy-in, which is a fair trade-up, I suppose, when it comes to the fact that we've lost a match. You know, it's not like they've added another match to All Out.
I'll say one nice thing about this. Matt Hardy has feud with the entire AEW's mid-card throughout the spring and summer of 2021 to the detriment of the mid-card. And I thought they'd abandoned the thread with Jurassic Express. They, in fact, have not. They were probably going to do this 10-man on a Dynamite or a Rampage. Obviously, we know that Pac Andrade off the card. So, circumstances permitting, they've done it here. That lets you know that they are doing so much work in the background that missing out on a pay-per-view match that they've promoted heavily isn't necessarily a disaster because they've done the work elsewhere.
Mm.
Oh, God, Matt Hardy isn't doing anything to get these people over realistically, and that's his role.
Mm.
You're meant to work with an established veteran, and, you know, maybe some of the hidden things, the dark arts of how to work a match and how to structure a match that we're not completely au fait with will help the likes of Cassidy. He's an awesome in-ring storyteller anyway. There's an argument to be made that the mainstream of WWE for years and years and years might not be the best necessary way of bringing on talent. Different conversation. The reality is that the knowledge one might accrue from working with a Matt Hardy for several weeks at a time, that might inform their experience, their expertise, whatever. It doesn't really entertain me in the moment. You know, just have him as a backstage coach teaching psychology class if that's the case. No one feels any more hot working with Matt Hardy after the fact.
Mm.
And that wouldn't be an issue if he wasn't on television every single week. When there are certain performers like Sammy Guevara, Hikaru Shida, several more, John Silver, who aren't getting the same amount of TV time.
Yeah.
The trade-off simply is not in the favor of the audience. I'm getting bored. He's not burying anyone. He's not dragging anyone down, but no one's better off.
No.
His opponents, the fans, I still think he's got a role to play. There are certain Matt Hardy promos that have popped me daft, like when he was falling asleep after losing to Christian Cage, because I think his fourth child had just been born. Mm-hmm. He's got a sense of humor. He's done some fabulous bits on BTE. there is a rule for Matt Hardy to play. I don't want him to play this one.
Yeah, that's fair.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, let's talk about Eddie Kingston and Miro. Now, there are a lot of times on other podcasts, maybe, where you'll say you're talking longer than this actually took place. Normally when it's regards to a match on Monday Night Raw, for example. That's going to happen here, because I've already talked about it for about 20 seconds. This whole thing went 54 seconds, I believe. I glanced at it on the Twitter today so I could get this all verbatim. It was something like that. And yeah, we're going to pile the praise on this and talk about how Miro is quite possibly your favourite wrestler in AEW right now. So, we start with Eddie Kingston. They haven't really done a lot, I think it's fair to say, to sell this match. Miro said, I want to speak to Eddie Kingston. Then he unmasked and murdered Fuego del Sol, and then Eddie Kingston came out and brawled with him on Rampage. So Eddie Kingston, cutting a promo, talks about the kryptonite of Miro, his Achilles heel, his neck. That's why people keep going for the DDT. He's going to be going after everything that Miro desires, that TNT championship, because if he wins that, if Miro loses it, he's no longer God's favorite. He says to Miro, take my hand. We're going to walk through hell together. What a line. And maybe if you survive that, you're going to go to your God's heaven. It switches to Miro. And Miro says, you know, you talk about all this bollocks, basically. I didn't get the first bit of it, but he says, because I was too excited to write this line down. God's favourite only stays down for his wife in a hotel room after a victory. He says that the Mad King will realise that redemption only comes after agony. He says, I'm coming to bring both. This is the word of the Redeemer. 54 seconds that sold me on this match instantly.
A few dissenting voices, and I understand where they are coming from, because I would lap up all of this that could be delivered to me, and I hope this feud isn't over. It must continue. There's no irony. This feud literally must continue. A few dissenting voices saying, oh, this is great. I want more of it. Do you? Or do you want two incredible badasses drenched in machismo to sell you on a match in under a minute? If they can do that, let them do it. That's awesome. It allows more space for epic matches, big angles, longer promos on the show. It is the ultimate in what a pro wrestler should do. Economy. Like, everything's so bloated. The only thing we're worried about at All Out, which looks like an awesome card on paper, is AEW's propensity, consistent with the wider trends of pro wrestling, to give people far too much and to exhaust them. If you can do your stuff to this incredible level and get it over in a tiny amount of time, yes, please, thank you. You don't need any more than this. Me and Murray have got contrasting wrestling philosophies. He says it's better when it's totally basic. Not basic as in bad, but the most elemental stuff done expertly. Mm. I prefer an intricate saga along the lines of a Hangman Page and Kenny Omega. My God, I almost had a paradigm shift in my own watching this. How much more needed to be done other than this immaculate 1 minute of television? The story is so goddamn simple, and it's delivered in such a cool way. Eddie Kingston saying, take my hand and walk through hell. That's like, what I love about Eddie Kingston is that he sees an honour in fighting, and I love that. And what I love about Miro is that he is simply just the man at the moment. Top shagger, invincible hard bastard, scary individual. This match is going to rule because Eddie Kingston, as promised, is going to drop him on his neck with suplexes. The near falls are going to be electrifying. The tough guy machismo, no-selling posturing is going to be just proper real champsh.
And for all the people who say, oh, you know, AEW does all this flippy bollocks and kicks out of everything, this match centers around a DDT, let's not forget.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not, you know, besmirching the DDT, but in terms of the maneuvers that we see in AEW, it's pretty basic. Yeah. It's a DDT.
Yeah, this is just going to rule so hard. Like, the bare elements of this are so great. Eddie Kingston says, I'm going to break your neck. That's a scary, cool threat. In response, Miro says, I only lie down when my wife sits on my cack. You put him over as this invincible ladies man, except he's loyal as well. He's only got one lady in his life. His hot, flexible wife.
I said this to you this morning. I might actually agree for once with a live sex celebration on a wrestling television show if Miro wins this.
Jesus Christ. Just the most badass stuff.
Yeah.
Proper badass stuff. I love it, Maggle.
Then we got a video package promoting Moxley versus Kojima for All Out, which Moxley called him a crazy ass old man. Tickled me.
Love that. He says he's going to do egregious, felonious violence. That's awesome as
well. To a 50-year-old.
And that's going to be lit as well.
Right, let's talk about, we mentioned it earlier, let's talk about Chris Jericho's response to MJF, his in-ring interview with Jim Ross, who was very emotional. You were loving this. Very emotional.
Oh my God, what a great carny. And I mean that in the nicest possible way.
Yes.
Either Jim Ross is put on the performance of a lifetime by being genuinely emotional at the prospect of someone he's close with. Lest we forget, Jim Ross and Chris Jericho were having conversations with the Khans in 2019 before we even knew anything. They are linked together. They told us how far away, how long they've been linked together. If Jim Ross wasn't visibly upset at the idea that this is one of the last times he can sell or even call a Chris Jericho fight, and he's worked this, what a performance from Jim Ross. The guy gets buried because he's a bit of a pervert and he makes loads of mistakes and doesn't care that much about certain aspects of AEW's in-ring. I have to put him over specifically to the hilt here. Incredible work. And if it isn't a work, great. Have people show emotions because that's what it's all about.
Well, I'm not sure about that. No emotions in wrestling, mate. Come on. Jericho gets on the mic and does, welcome to Chicago is Jericho. He talks about starting his main event journey in just business 22 years ago in Chicago. Talked about JR recruiting him, as you mentioned, to start that journey. JR, quivering in his voice, asked why he picked such an extreme stipulation for this match with MJF. And Chris Jericho said, good question. Just very quickly, MJF, you're a piece of sh. Basically, he said, look, you're diabolical, you're arrogant, you're just like me, and all you've got over me are those three victories, and I just can't let it go. The reason I'm here, the reason I came here, the reason why this whole thing started is because I can't be complacent. Look, there's never a guarantee that AEW is going to succeed, but yet here we are, episode 101, as the hottest wrestling company in the world today. Huge bap. Said, look, I could stick around for longer. I could have matches wherever I fancy with whoever I fancied. But every time I look in the mirror, I'd think, you couldn't be MJF. But you know what? I don't want this to be the end. I want more. I don't want it to stop, and that's why I have to take the chance. If something goes wrong on Sunday and his journey ends right where it began in Chicago, so be it. He's going to move to the commentary desk. He's going to thank everyone for their support. But he said MJF's not going to take this away from him. If MJF wants to take him out, he's going to have to be the best he's ever been, break every bone, etc., etc. But that's not going to happen. God damn it, he's Chris Jericho. MJF doesn't have what it takes to get rid of him. And he says, concludes by saying, I'll see you on Sunday at All Out, you little prick.
Again, another terrific verbal performance on a show. Just absolutely resplendent in exceptional promo work. This was another great promo. Jim Ross sold it. There was one little detail that I loved about Chris Jericho's promo here. The whole promo was great. The idea that if you're going to be generous about this, and I'm a generous reviewer because I believe in the product and the thought and the passion that goes into crafting it, beating MJF once for him isn't necessarily a measure that he's won the feud. It's just a relief at this point. He kind of accepts that MJF is the better guy. He's beaten him three times. He just needs to beat him once for the sake of his ability to continue to do this. That might be a generous interpretation. What I love about this promo was in the first line, Chicago is Jericho, because for 2 years of his AEW career, Chris Jericho has repelled any chance of Y2J in a bit of a dickheaded fashion. These people are chanting his name because they like him. He's going, shut up, I'm not Y2J anymore. I reinvent myself all of the time. He's like, he loves being the reinvention guy. And so he should. It's impossible to stay over as long as he has without getting resented in weekly, all of the time pro wrestling. He's done a tremendous job, and God damn it, he knows it as much as anybody else. They check my name, huh? Piss off. Check the new name. I'm a reinventor. For him to dial back the years and enjoy being an older version of Chris Jericho was such a smart, subtle move, because it put over the idea of, oh, this is the last time he does it. Why not get a little bit of call and response? Because I love this crowd so much. I love the adoration I get from this crowd. If I have to do one more promo to build one more match, I'm going to indulge myself one more time. Exquisite detail. Like, genuinely, if you think about how much he hates the Y2J stuff, to do a little snippet of Y2J really brought home. Maybe you just want to do one more shortcut to a pop, because that might be the last time he gets a pop to build a match.
Yeah, really, really nice stuff. And as you alluded to, he came out to Judas and appreciated it, but there was that look in his eye of like, this could be one of the last times this is happening.
I don't think it is, but they've worked it so fabulously.
Another great video package came next, a response to CM Punk effectively from Darby Allin saying, look, you know, CM Punk said when he was if he was 15, he'd be a fan of him. Well, when I was 15, I was a fan of CM Punk, but he talked about feeling overlooked. CM Punk said he was first on his list. Well, I should be the last name on the list. I know what I need to do, though, to correct all these problems and issues that I'm having with all this. I have to beat CM Punk in Chicago or die trying. And he's fenced that he will.
Again.
Not beat him, but he'll die trying.
AEW are fabulous at conveying a real sense of high drama and anxiety about these matches and the stakes behind them. We'll get to that in the main event. Jesus Christ, I'm terrified of this cage match. This was, again, exceptional. This first hour of Dynamite, outside of the post-match of the Orange Cassidy, was just un-goddamn believable. And speaking of unbelievable, this was so believable. Who else was going to be Darby Allin, straight-edge punk guy who named himself after a legend of the punk scene? Of course CM Punk is going to be his favourite wrestler. Of course, CM Punk has been saying that line in media and on TV to build to this line, to further the strand of mutual respect. Awesome. And I also love the idea of Darby Allin recognizing a few things that we've noted of our. Isn't it nice that Darby Allin's CM Punk's first opponent? The implication being the first of many on his way to a main event world title run. And Darby Allin's like, no, do not piss me off and patronize me. I've wanted that. I've wanted Phil Brooks to be CM Punk. I got everything I needed out of something I was being very pedantic about. Perfection.
Then we got Powerhouse Hobbs versus Brian Cage. Been waiting a while for the fallout from this and Brian Cage and Team Taz. And felt like it was worth the wait because they beat the crap out of each other here. Brian Cage attacking Hobbs during his entrance, hoying him into the barricade, hooks there at ringside. He distracts Cage to allow Hobbs to cut him off with an elbow drop. Hobbs mocks Cage, then just hits him with a sodding flatliner in response. And the finish of this sees both men go for finishers. Hobbs hit a huge spine buster for a two count. Cage comes back, hits a rising knee and a sort of F5 outside in vertical suplex. Just defies logic what he can do, especially with someone the size of Powerhouse Hobbs. But as Cage looks like he's got the match won and he's about to finish him off and finally get that redemption, Hook jumps up on the apron in his leather trousers, distracts the official, and that allows Hobbs to push Brian Cage into the ropes, where Ricky Starks, the absolute beast that he is, jumps up on there, twats him with the FTW Championship. Hobbs hits his finisher. 1, 2, 3. What a brawl.
I've got a... I don't want to piss on your chips. I've got a take here.
Mm-hmm.
AEW's long-term storytelling is in fact sometimes so long term, it's so well thought out in advance, and so well foreshadowed before the actual factions implode and the conflicts arise, that sometimes like a really fun, or a quite fun match that this was, physically impressive, some cool moments, just buckle under the weight of the expectation that That's it fair. Presents for itself. Ordinarily, in a vacuum, I'd have enjoyed this match a lot more if they'd not invested so much TV time in it. And of course, as we've said quite often, Brian Cage isn't really it. It's a really fun worker for his genre, the whole incredulous, Christ, him doing that. He's not a big episodic TV guy who you can really embark on an emotionally invested journey in. In a vacuum, something like this would have been way more fun. But the fact that they spent so long building to it, when it actually happens, sometimes these things can only resonate as an anticlimax.
Yeah.
Certain matches and certain characters don't necessarily fit the big, sprawling saga of AEW's trademark in-house storytelling. Mm. And I couldn't help but feel like all of that for this. This is fun in a vacuum, nothing more, and yet they've built this bastard for ages, and I'm thinking... that was a decent payoff, I guess. The actual thought behind timing of the finish, really well done.
Yeah.
Leathered him with a belt. I forgot Ricky Starks was there. Really nice heel stuff. But again, sometimes you just need to get to the bloody point.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Another great promo came next. Alistair Black sitting in a room calling out people for fights. I mean, it's exactly the same as WWE. I'm joking. I'm just saying.
He actually has the fight, asshole.
Yeah. And I was saying to you earlier in the office, that's exactly what performative twats are going to say on Twitter today. How's this different from what he did in WWE? Well, probably because he keeps kicking people's heads off and he'll do it again on Friday on Rampage. Malakai Black, of course, is talking about Lee Johnson. He's given him 7 days to atone for his involvement at the end of last week's Dynamite. He said he didn't run off from Lee Johnson. He done what he needs to do, kill the Andersons. And speaking of which, he's going to murder Lee Johnson and place coins on his eyes so he can pay the bloke at the River Styx when he sends him to hell, basically.
That visual is going to look awesome.
Yes.
He's going to kill Lee Johnson. He's alluded as well. This one's not going to be a squash. It was a coded message.
Enjoy
it, take my time. This is going to be like the proper Aleister Black does it. Back and forth. Malakai Black does a back and forth.
Is this the first potential one where he does the raising the red on his foot thing, do you reckon?
Potentially it happens. It feels a little bit corny, but in all the best ways, this eye thing. If, in fact, it looks like he has murdered a man in the middle of the ring, the coins on the eye, that could be an awesome, quite stirring visual thumbnail potential.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Very good point. Right. Let's talk about what happened next. It's QT Marshall.
Sorry, one more thing before I get in the mood with this. I'm so glad he foreshadowed it and told you what he was going to do. Not only does it make him more convincing and believable because he actually puts his actions, he just does what he says he's going to do, essentially. If he hadn't said the symbolism behind what he's going to do on Friday, poor Excalibur, as he's been asked to do too often, would have to like recap an entire debutante's career in like a minute. That's a blade! That's the Japanese death legend Luther. Hades! People think, what?
River Styx! Hades! Read about his school, remember?
Don't be the ferryman! It's Christopher!
Right. QT Marshall's in the ring. He's got the factory with him.
What is this?
He calls out Paul White, heavyweight to heavyweight, he says. Well, it did tickle me. I'll give him that. Paul White comes out. He knows exactly what he's about to get into. Steps in the ring, and QT Marshall sets everyone in the factory on him. And they do that thing where they beat him down in a corner, and he explodes out of it. Everyone goes flying. He chokeslams someone. Aaron Solo's like, don't worry, lads. I've got this. I'm climbing up the top rope. Jumps off. Just takes him out of the air, basically. And the Gun Club slide in the ring. Great slide, I'll say that, from Billy Gunn. Lovely slide. Slides into the ring to flank the Big Show. Sorry, to flank Paul White. Muscle memory there. And cover him off. QT Marshall gets a chair, goes to jump in. Gets just pushed off the apron, basically. And you think, oh, what was that bollocks? And then... Mom, can we have the Shield breaking up? No, we've got the Shield breaking up at home. Billy Gunn just hits Paul White with a chair. I initially thought that was an awful chair shot because he's missed the part of his back that he's meant to be hitting, obviously. But actually good explanation from commentary, basically saying they're going for that surgically repaired hip of his. Yeah, Billy Gunn hits him in the hip, keeps battering him a couple of times with the chair and stands over him. As QT just can't believe what he's seeing. And as they leave, everyone else in the factory comes in, picks up Paul White, and QT Marshall hits an assisted diamond cutter on Paul White. What did you think of the Gun Club betraying Paul White here, Sitch?
Right. Because he wears the T-shirts or the shirts, QT Marshall, that is, I'm going to do... a very bad Tony Soprano impression. Oh. How could this happen? How could this happen? How could Billy Gunn and Paul White have a feud in AEW in 2021? I'm serious. I was mystified by this development. Mystified that they would do Paul White and Billy Gunn on telly in 2021 in AEW. But I'm legitimately asking myself, how could this happen? How people... myself included, look at that ziggity-stacked AEW roster in 2021. And you worry how they're going to accommodate all of these names. The rotating cast, very good. But at the same time, people will forget about certain people and it's hard to keep people hot.
Yeah, at the same time, where's Hikaru Shida in all this?
And I'm thinking, right, well, who hasn't been on telly for a while? Who was getting over on telly big... to the point where you'd kind of want to push them and make money off them and present them as stars because people want to receive them as stars. Where's Sammy Guevara? All right, well, his TV time is now even greater premium because Paul White's having a feud with Billy Gunn in 2021. Where's Hikaru Shida? Has done anything on TNT since Double or Nothing? Riho, thank Christ, is back and is fine after her poor adverse reaction to the vaccine. Still get vaccinated, you assholes. Oh, she can't really be in it because there's one women's match per week. Can there be two? No, we've got to make way for Paul White versus Billy Gunn in 2021. How could this happen? People say, oh, God, that's too much. You've got Kenny Omega. You've got Hangman Page. You've got John Moxley. You've got CM Punk. You've got Bryan Danielson. You've got Eddie Kingston. You've got Miro. You've got MJF. You've got Chris Jericho. You've got all of these names, this roster is unbelievable. Cody Rhodes, Malakai Black, the Young Bucks. How can you fit all of these, even on 3 hours? Well, there's got to be a way, because we're doing Paul White versus Billy Gunn in 2021 on AEW. How could this happen? I don't get... my mind was destroyed by this segment. You get... God, just 3 hours of TV time. This roster... yeah, you can get Billy. How does this happen?
Yeah, I think it speaks volumes that when you and I met up or walking into work today... on this show, with all that happened on it, from the Miro Kingston promo to the return of Anna Jay, we'll get to in a second, to the closing angle, to everything that happened, FTR, Santana and Ortiz, MJF, Chris Jericho. The first thing we said was, so Billy Gunn attacked Big Show with a chair last night.
Billy Gunn is loved backstage. Mm. By all accounts, he's big banter Billy Gunn. Really good coach. He's a coach, goddammit. He's not a TV star. So that's a bit of nepotism, again, creeping into AEW at the expense of loads of people I want to see wrestle. Sammy Guevara, Hikaru Shida, John Silver.
Mm.
How could this happen? And Paul White, after looking lean and svelte and somewhat mobile in the last couple of times he's had to do something vaguely physical, looked thrashed here. Slow lumbering, and he's selling it to some extent. Let's move on.
Yeah, more concerning is the fact that Andy Murray pointed out, oh no, this isn't going to be a 1 minute KO punch match now.
You've got a body part to work, a brother.
I was going to work the hip for 20 minutes, and I was like, oh God. Anyway, cheeky bastard that she is, Britt Baker had a special announcement next about a free agent signing a long-term contract with AEW. Before that, though, she announced she's bringing some star power to the Casino Battle Royale. Reba and Jamie Hayter are being added into it. The numbers in that are, I think there's only two spaces left. Where you have to be some, I don't know, iconic names to fill those two spots. Anyway, she says, one of the hottest stars in all of pro wrestling has just signed a long-term contract with AEW, guaranteed to keep the ratings sky high. And that name is Britt Baker. Brilliant. She can make a match as well as that whenever she wants. So she's going to be facing Chris Statlander on Friday. Cheeky this, but I enjoyed it.
I thought it was absolutely unbelievable. She knew what exactly she was doing. What a marvelous, resourceful bit of TV time this was. It built two matches, a rampage in the paper. It was a wonderful platform for Britt Baker to be piss funny and a great heel, and read it very much as a tacit tease that Adam Cole is in fact going to sign with AEW. I don't think she does this knowing that Adam Cole, I can't wait to see him in AEW. I cannot wait. Basically, ever rising Adam Cole made me not quit doing the NXT podcasts, and now that three of them, the three that I like other than Cameron Grimes, you know, like Thatcher and Ciampa being there, I'm being facetious. Yeah. You got three of the guys I really like in NXT, in AEW, as Vince McMahon seizes control of what is ostensibly going to be main event with greener talent.
I'm so excited.
Can we please retire the NXT podcast?
Yeah, it might be time to take it around the back of the shed and put two bullets in the back of
it. Double tap, boom, boom.
I may have just said she's facing Chris Statlander.
Woof, woof, boom, boom.
I may have just said she's facing Chris Statlander on Friday. I got that wrong, of course. It's going to be Reba and Jamie Hayter in a handicap match on Rampage on Friday, which we'll preview on the Friday podcast about Rampage. Anyway, Penelope Ford, Tay Conti was next. Immediately, Tay Conti dives off the apron to hit a crossbody on both of them because the bunny is, of course, there from what happened on Rampage on Friday. She's hoying Ford all over the ring after the bell rings, of course. Turns a backbreaker into a roll-up for a two count. She hits a pump kick. It's another two count. Comes off or goes to go off the top ropes, but Ford pushes them to send her crashing to the mat as we head into the ads. Ford later on hits a handspring spear. Then Conti comes back with a slam for a near fall. Ford goes for the mutual lock, but Conti fights out of it. She puts the calf slicer on, and Ford struggles to get to the ropes. Conti's still in control when Ford counters with a double knee gutbuster for a nice two count. And Ford takes the official to allow Bunny to get involved. It looks like we're just going to see a repeat of what we saw on Friday. But Conti shoves her off the apron, rolls up Ford, 1, 2, 3. And then, yet again, another correct call by you and I. It is the numbers game again. Penelope Ford and the Bunny beating down Tay Conti post-match when who should return but Anna Jay to chase them off. Tay Conti is clearly ecstatic for this. I think she was meant to be out for potentially up to 12 months, only just 6-7 months after she injured her shoulder in training. Anna Jay is back. She's going to be part of the Casino Battle Royal. It was a very quick call in Excalibur's ear by Tony Khan. Yeah, I know, a load of bollocks.
So basically, anyway, Miro and Kip Sabian take 8 months to get the friggin' match with best friends. 8 long months. And this one takes 8 milliseconds. Yeah.
It literally, she returns. Everyone's a member of the NRJ community. And
Jim Ross is.
Yeah, and Tony Khan's going, get her in the casino bar royal. Bloody hell, we need more women in there. That's basically what happened. But yes, what did you make of Anna Jay's return in this match?
Actual narrative development. A nice anti-Vince Russo energy to the post-match. Thank Christ, can you imagine if he booked this? You conniving bitch, you took my spot when you were away. You don't know what... I think I've got AJ Styles and Anna Jay confused. Yeah. She's not actually a hick. So, really nice post.
You know, whilst Tay Conti was doing all this, what was Anna Jay doing before? I'm sorry I interrupted you.
I just love AJ, man. Love taking the piss out of AJ. What a guy. Great, great source of material. Hot little match, not in a Jim Ross way, but like a really well-worked match. And I say well-worked because the continued slot that the women get means that fans at this point have been conditioned to go, right, it's a women's match. It's the buffer before the important things with the men. So, Conti got a nice pop, but they are conditioned to think, oh, this isn't really significant. Because I know, as an audience member, that it's the thing that happens. I just want to get something out of the way to convince you to come to the main event. They had a nice match that was quite snug, convincing. Conti stuff, the strikes look great. There's still a little bit of a footwork thing that I'm sure will come with more and more reps. They really worked the crowd into it. Loads of nice little strikes, submissions. Just a nicely put together match that the crowd really got into because they are well behind Conti, whose facial expressions were great. Situationally different demeanor considering the events that happened to her on Friday. She didn't just do her entrance pull. She did it to a degree, but she had a stone-faced, I'm going to mess somebody up because I'm pissed off demeanor. Love that. Yeah. Absolutely love that. This was genuinely another promising development in a women's division that really needs to deliver on those promises consistently.
Thunder Rose is backstage before with the main event, getting questioned about her chances in the Battle Royal. When in comes Nyla Rose and Jade Cargill to beat her up, basically. And she says, was this supposed to intimidate me? Because if I'm going to go down, I'm going to go down swinging. She tries to fight both of them off. But again, it's Nyla Rose and Jade Cargill working together. They beat her down. And then they go to face-to-face when Smart Mark Sterling steps in between them. Cleverly, good. Makes sense. And bargains with them and with Vicky Guerrero, who's, of course, the manager of Nyla Rose, to say, look, there's money to be made if we don't go at it. Let's save this for Sunday, girl, sort of thing. And they leave Thunder Rosa laid out before the pay-per-view.
Nice little breadcrumbs. You're going to get the Nyla Rose, Jay Cargill showdown, and it's going to get a pop. And they've built it as an organic layer in the match. It's the sort of thing that happens in most battle royals. The fact that they've done a little bit of a tease of that on telly hopefully will inform the moment when it happens. They've done a decent, by their standards, which aren't particularly great in booking women's wrestling, they've done a decent job of like threading little hooks into the match and dangling them so that fans can pick up on it in Chicago when it actually happens. It's bare minimum stuff, to be honest, but at least they are doing it.
Right, let's get to the 8-man main event. It was the Elite, the Young Bucks, and the Gubrillas, that is, of the Elite, to take on the Lucha Bros and Jurassic Express ahead, of course, the Young Bucks versus Lucha Bros in a steel cage for the tag titles on Sunday. The big men started off, Gallows and Luchasaurus. Big strikes from the both of them. Luchasaurus hit a nice vertical suplex to bring in Rey Fénix and Nick Jackson. They have a nice back and forth again. They tag in their brothers, effectively, for both of them, for a nice little exchange. Early on, you know, sort of back and forth action. I think we go to a break quite early on in the match, during which Jungle Boy got powerbombed on the apron. Then it starts to get good. Rey Fénix, computer game. I don't know how to describe it. Like, I want to say Rey Fénix hops all around the ropes, but that doesn't give it enough justice. Computer games is the only way I can describe it. Bounces, bottom rope, middle rope, other rope, next to your rope, over, legs not on the rope, legs on the rope, hips on the rope. I don't, you know what he does. Anyway, he hits a step-up springboard arm drag, basically. on Nick Jackson after fighting off Carl Anderson. Penta hits a thrust kick and then missile drop kicks someone's arse. Matt breaks up the pin attempt. Nick hit a mad arm drag combo thing as well. And then all four of them are going to be in the tag match on Sunday. Super kick each other to knock everyone down. Great stuff. In comes Luchasaurus later to take on Carl Anderson. Hits a choke slam, hits a standing moonsault, gets a two count off that. In comes Penta. They set up for the Fear Factor, but the official's distracted. And of course, that git, Brandon Cutler, gets involved to cold spray Ray Phoenix's eyes, and that allows the Good Brothers to hit a magic killer on him for a near fall. Great stuff there. And again, reiterating the need for a steel cage on Sunday. Ray Phoenix counters a BTE trigger, hits a double handspring cutter on the Bucks. That looked great. Fights off the Good Brothers, but that allows the Bucks to recover, catch him in a crossbody, and hit the Meltzer driver. 1, 2, 3. I'll tell you what, let's talk the match, and then we'll talk the fallout of the match afterwards.
The match was awesome. It took a little bit while to get going, but when it did, it was just a furious adrenaline festival that you'd obviously expect given the people involved in it. This accomplished subtly two things. When Jungle Boy got taken out, he at least got taken out. That apron bump was absolutely brutal. It's one of those things where you can't recap it. There's not a particularly great story or a particularly substantial story. You know what you're going to get. They'll tell a more substantial one on Sunday, I'm sure. But for now, it was a tease of the great wrestling you're going to see. But in addition to that, the Young Bucks and Lucha Brothers have had better matches. They've been involved in better matches together than this, which was still on the 4-star level because it was absolutely ballistic by the end. But I was watching their stuff closely, and I don't think they've ever been as locked in to their incredible chemistry. In considering the ambition of the stuff they do to each other, how good that chemistry has to be, they've never looked as locked in to what they can do together as they did for these brief, thrilling glimpses of what's going to happen on Sunday. They worked incredibly well together. I was desperate to see the match following this. They did a nice little story beat with the double super kicks to establish the idea of they are so locked in and they are so close together in terms of the quality level that they are super kicking each other in the face with inch perfect time and they're inseparable, basically. That was the thread that you were asked to pick up. Their work together just looked phenomenal. And it's so weird. Pinning your challenger, which is what they did here with Phoenix, ordinarily I would bury. Maybe it's biased. But is it a clue that there's actually going to be a title switch?
Yeah.
Is it an overt... Are they playing on the knowledge of our history of how these things happen in WWE to make us think that one's going to happen? Otherwise, if they beat them twice, is that the best idea? We'll find out on Sunday, but it was certainly effective in the moment to make you think, oh, they're going to win at the pay-per-view because there's no distractions at the pay-per-view and they were going very distraction mad again in this eight-man. Their work was electrifying to the point where I'm thinking they're going to have a surefire match of the year candidate, even more sure than I was this time yesterday.
Yeah, I think the thing is, like you say, they're playing on the audience's knowledge of usually the losers on Sunday stand tall on the TV beforehand. That doesn't mean anything when it comes to AEW because they're more complicated than that. And like you say, Lucha Bros were winning until Brandon Cutler got involved with the cold spray again. They were going for one of their finishers, so... Yeah, like you say, I don't think it takes anything away. And it was all about what happened after this as well. Kenny Omega, with his new black hair, comes out.
He wants to put some salt in that pepper, I think. It's distracting.
Yeah, he's flanked by Michael Nakazawa, of course.
That's the very first thing I've said on this podcast that is vaguely critical of Kenny Omega.
Ever.
So
they obviously... ridiculous numbers game allows them to beat up the baby faces. Omega's just cutting promo on them as he's doing this, taunting all of them. They put, I think, Luchasaurus through a table with a magic killer. And Christian Cage, of course, he's challenging Omega on Sunday for the title. He comes out to attack him, but it's the numbers game. It's what the Elite always rely upon. He gets overwhelmed, and then Omega gets on the mic and talks about having a lovely, lovely dinner, a lovely chat with Tony Khan. But he does have to be careful with his belongings. he's stolen the key or whatever it is, the lever or whatever it is, tells Don Callis to lower the cage to allow them to beat up all the people they're going to be facing on Sunday without anyone getting in. So, you know, it's I think it was JR who said this is meant to be keeping them out on Sunday, but right now it's keeping them trapped in with all their opponents effectively. People run down to try and get into the cage. Marco,
can't, it's a cage, it's great.
Marco Stunt tries to climb up, gets cold sprayed. Same with sort of Dante Martin, Frankie Kazarian, obviously is there, Orange Cassidy. Cold spray for everyone, basically. And kendo sticks for everyone, too, that just get whipped around everyone. They've handcuffed the Lucha Bros to the ropes. They hit thrust kicks on just about everyone. And then together, they all hit the BTE trigger on Christian as the show goes off the air in this wild conclusion. The Elite stand tall before All Out, Michael Sidgwick.
Yeah, it felt more confusing and laboured than the chaos they were going for. The fact that I didn't have this white hot heat backdrop, and I think I love Kenny Omega, and I'm going to tell you why I love Kenny Omega in a second, but his kind of stilted delivery amid all this chaos just made it feel way more baggy and contrived than I think they were going for. So I wasn't the biggest fan of the post-match angle in terms of the execution. The idea was great. The execution was iffy. I'll not lie about that, because why would I? I love the idea of them attempting to scale this enormous cage that they cannot, in fact, successfully scale, because it is a cage that is enormous, designed to keep people out of it.
If only there was footholds going to the side of it, that would have really been helpful.
Yeah, I know. So that was great in theory. Kenny Omega playing this arch, exaggerated theatrical character is the only person who can get over the concept of a cage-lowering mechanism, or whatever he said, over. And I'll tell you what, there were certain points throughout the show with various camera angles, and I thought, oh, they've got the cage up there. And I'm thinking, oh, God, they've got the cage up there. They're going to do the WWE thing where it magically lowers because, listen, you idiots, watch this. You're going to get a cage match on Sunday, right? Got it. Message received. I know what a cage match is. You must see the cage. You must see the ladders. Like, I'm not an idiot. So I thought it was going to magically lower.
Yeah.
But the fact that they've done that little wrinkle, that little storyline detail, no matter how, you know, cartoonish.
Tony Khan's cage lowering button, do not push.
Yeah, it's a bit daft, but at the same time, I'm so glad they went to the effort, because I hate the cage magically lowers, because you idiots wouldn't think about it. You have to see it, because you're morons. So they addressed that with a cute, wacky storyline detail that I appreciated, and they sold the power of the cage, and they beat down the baby faces you want to see win on Sunday. Just mostly glorious stuff end to end in the main event segment, but I did think that it was just a bit messy.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe they went a bit early. I don't know. Like you say, it just felt like, oh, do this. And like you say, he's like, oh, watch out for this guy. Oh, hit him with a kendo stick. Yeah. Do this now. It felt a bit
Or maybe Callis. Like, Kenny Omega is a sensational promo. Callis is probably, because he's a great promo and a better commentator, is better at this kind of running commentary stuff that Kenny Omega does do a lot.
And Kenny had to get physical as well, so he kept handing the mic to people.
Yeah, it doesn't always land, this running commentary bit. Sometimes it does, this time it didn't. Callis, being a great promo and a great commentator, should do this running commentary bit.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. But in terms of a lot of what they did on this show, in terms of getting people to do the old shut up and take my money, I think they couldn't have done a lot more ahead of Sunday.
Yeah, definitely. Great go-home show.
Yeah, and looking forward to Rampage as well on Friday night. Let us know your thoughts on AEW Dynamite, though, on Twitter at WhatCultureWWE. Well, actually, they can follow both of us. You can follow Michael Sidgwick at
MSidgwick.
You can follow me at Adam Wilborn. Follow us all at WhatCultureWWE. And make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts. As I mentioned, the AEW Rampage preview will be there tomorrow. And later on today, myself, Sidge, and Andy are going to be talking all about the potential of Daniel Bryan, or as I should start calling him more often, Bryan Danielson in AEW. God, ambassador, they are spoiling us. Right, okay.
We still get Billy Gunn versus Paul White.
Yeah, swings and roundabouts. Yeah.
How can this happen?
Anyway, this has been the AEW Dynamite Review. My thanks to Michael Sidgwick. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you soon.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.